I know a lot of you have some extra time on your hands, and maybe you're looking for something good to listen to. Well, there's always the American Fashion Podcast Archives. As we rapidly approach our 250th episode, which will be released very soon, there are well over 200 episodes in the archive, with wonderful interviews and stories we've collected over the last several years. Top designers, smart salespeople, marketing gurus, just a whole menagerie of smart fashion people telling their stories in there. And during the health crisis, we've cut the price of our monthly subscription to the archives in half. So go to AmericanFashionPodcast.com and click on Archives to find the Fashion Together special. It's only $3.50 per month right now, and if you sign up, that means you've locked in that rate for the future. Why $3.50? Well, there's a lake in Scotland. This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, here with Kathy Sheppas.
Hey, everyone.
And our guests in the studio are the president and executive vice president of sales and executive vice president of production at Badgley Mischka. And if you remember, Mark and James were on the show a few months ago, back in September. And now we meet the other three co-founders of their company. So Christine Currents.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
You're the president of Badgley Mischka.
Yes.
And Kim Lee Sui, did I say that right?
Sue.
Kim Lee Sue.
Yeah.
You're the executive vice president of production, and Laura Pirpato?
You got that perfectly.
All right. executive vice president of sales. This is episode 247 of American Fashion Podcast, recorded in February of 2020. You all are the business side of Badgley Mischka. How did that happen?
Well, we have five partners, like you said, Mark, James, and the three of us. And we formed the company in 2008. And at the time, we were just the apparel license for Badgley Mischka. That's how we started the company. The brand was still owned by Iconics Brand Group. And the way they worked is everything is licensed. So we were the apparel licensee, with the mindset that we always wanted to own the brand, that we were creating all this value and we were working so well together and loving what we were doing, but, you know, doing it for someone else. And it wasn't making sense. And so we set out on the mission, and it took quite a long time to accomplish, but we managed to buy the brand from Iconics.
That's great. Now, how did you get started working together? Had you been a team for a long time?
So when we started the company, we were working at separate companies, but we had all met one another through our history in the fashion business. And so when this opportunity came up, or I thought there was this opportunity, I reached out to Lara and Kim, who I had known and who were, you know, the best people that I've ever worked with in their particular fields of business and expertise. And so I knew that together with them and with Mark and James, that we could just be a great team.
And how's the business going right now? I mean, you've had it back in the hands of the people who founded it and yourselves now. How's it going? What's it feel like being? I mean, it's got to be a different thing than running it for other people and running it for yourselves.
So we acquired it in 2016. So since then, we have really spent so much time repositioning the brand, reworking the brand. You know, even though it's this timeless glamour, it has a 30-year history, we have to stay new and inventive and think of things and doing them differently. And so not sticking with the old, you know, marketing and retail, you know, way of business that things have always gone, that we had to kind of think outside of the box and work on new product categories. And, you know, Mark and James just constantly talk about that since then, when they walk into the office, they're just the happiest they've ever been.
I think one thing that's interesting about Mark and James, though, even when we were not the actual owners of the brand, I think we all acted like we were. And maybe that's partly the key to our success and why we finally got there. I think every decision we made it based on what was best for the brand, not for our individual company. So it felt great when we got the company back, because I think we had more control over other product categories, and when you care so much about the design and the aesthetic and what you're doing for the brand, to be able to oversee all of it now has been tremendous for us. But I think we always sort of acted like it was our brand from the beginning.
So you do the sales side or production?
I do the sales side.
You do the sales side. How has the business of selling changed in the last couple of years? Because I know there's been a big upset in the retail business.
It's interesting. You know, what I find interesting about the world right now is when you read about what's happening at retail, it's pretty doom and gloom to some degree. I think for us, we've been really successful, and I think it's more to do with the product. I think we've really figured out that we want to be, we do timeless glamour. So I think when it comes to things like that, it's not as vulnerable as maybe some other parts of the business. So we're careful. Kim will tell you, we get in fights every day about our cut tickets, which is sort of like, how many are you going to produce? Are you going to overproduce? Are you going to make extra and assume that the market's going to want more? So we'll get into battles because obviously she's like, we've got to run this business really tight. But our sell-throughs have been tremendous at our major retailers, despite what's going on out there. So it's an interesting time, I think, to be in our world and in retail. You've got to make sure that what you're doing is right, because if not, I mean, you can see what's happening with a lot of brands out there.
I'm thinking about how differently the licensee business works from all other businesses. Mm-hmm. And so taking that back in-house, what were some of the major changes you were able to make in how those businesses were run?
Well, I think some companies can approach the licensing business as who's going to pay us the most amount of royalties, and not necessarily be so product-minded. And so I think the three of us really went into it, and Mark and James especially, feeling very product-minded, that this is – I want to touch every single piece of product that has Badge & Mischka's name on it. I want to sign off on it. I want to be a part of the creative process from the outset. So we changed the design process from the very beginning. So Mark and James have all the different licensed partners up at the beginning of the season, all of the design directors for those different divisions, and have, you know, a big kickoff to every single season. Here's the colors, here's the themes, here's the embroideries, here's the swatches, and they go on and on, and that's the beginning. And then they work with them, hand-holding them through the entire process. So then when you see it on the runway this Saturday at 10 a.m., it will be what they've been working on now for 6 months prior.
So now, Kimberly, mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi.
Just thinking in terms of production. So when you're bringing license, you know, when you bring businesses into your business, you think about how you can combine logistics. But you really have licenses that are all different.
It's different categories. So we have all the apparel. So it doesn't really intertwine too much. But if there was, we always extend like offers to help you guys, and like the little girls' clothing, like we have a little we share information, like certain stuff that she'll have and we'll have, it's like stuff like that. But
so what ended up becoming your biggest challenge in when the businesses came back? Is that right that I'm saying that when the businesses came back? Yeah.
The funny thing is that I never felt like we didn't have the business. Like she said, from the beginning, when we created this company, we always felt like we were the brand owners, and we were very proud of everything. What other people were doing, what we don't believe that it was right or wrong, we still did the right thing for Mark and James, because Mark and James are our business partners. So that's why it was kind of very circular. Mark and James were employees of Iconics, but yet at the same time, they're our business partners. And because it's their names on the logo, we always protected them. So that's why I don't really feel like there was a change. We've always been there with Mark and James from the beginning.
But then once the three of you were in charge, I'm understanding that you all got along to begin with, but now you were able to build a culture that you really wanted. So what was different maybe about the culture that you built?
I think in addition to what I was saying, we started with the design process. The other thing we did is, you know, we started a CEO summit with all of our different licensed partners, where we would bring them in annually and have meetings and talk about the business as a whole. Where are, you know, is each division seeing success? Where are they struggling? How can we help one another? How can we come together? You know, obviously, Lara's got amazing retailer relationships. How can she get involved in, you know, the sales with these different partners? Same with Kim. How can Kim help with the production of these different categories? And we really just approached it like that from a group where a lot of other brand owners, we've seen, did not want licensed partners talking with one another. They felt like it was going to become a giant bitch fest, for lack of a better word, where everyone was just going to complain about, you know, all their trials and tribulations and not come up with solutions. And we saw it as the exact opposite. We said, if somebody's struggling, we want to know about it. We want everybody to know about it. We want everybody to be able to gain info from this.
I think a key to what Christine's saying too is we no longer call them licensees internally. Like, we call them brand partners, which I think is a huge distinction in how we treat them and how we see them. For us, unless they're going to be our partners in the brand, it's not going to work for us or for them. So everything we do now is about partnering up with them and figuring out, how do we make them successful? As a brand, how do we come together to really make sure that everything feels correct and feels like the DNA of the brand? So it's really a partnership now versus, here's a license agreement, go make product and send us a check at the end of the quarter. So that idea, I think, is a kind of antiquated way of building partnerships with other companies that have expertise in other product categories.
Kim, have you always worked at big brands for production?
I would think so. I've only been in three companies. So each company, okay. I was there for like 8 years, and then 8 years, and then now it's going on 10 or 12? 10, 12 years, yeah.
Do you see big changes happening with, obviously, market pressures, but also technology in how production happens?
Well, we're still like evening gowns, so our technology doesn't really advance as much as like ready-to-wear or cut and sew. So ours is still hand-cut by the piece, and, you know, so there's not much technology that we would be using besides the pattern-making technology. That I've seen a switch over. It used to be all done by hand, but now it's done by computers. But other than that, the rest of the stuff, it's still like the old-school style.
What's your favorite part of the production process?
The fittings. I love doing fittings. I love to complain about my fittings, but I love my fittings because ultimately, at the end of the day, I have to wear a different hat. Who's this person that's wearing this dress? How do I make her look beautiful, like, and age appropriate? So it's just like every time it's like, this is for a younger person. This is for mother of the bride. This is for a grandmother of the bride, like something like that. So I really enjoy that. That's.
So are you fitting the end customers, or are you fitting on models who are the
I'm
right
I'm fitting
sizes?
On models on the right, size 4. So
okay.
And then, so she has a size 4 body, so it's beautiful. So I always have to say, well, it's not just for you. It's for this person. So that's when it becomes challenging, but I love it.
I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, when they look at some runway shows and other things, everything that goes into it. The runway show is a size 0, and it's made for that model. However, when it comes into production and it goes into Kim's hands, we are all about size inclusivity. So we've got size 0 all the way up to size 26. And so she's trying to make sure that this dress or this gown is going to be perfectly fit for any size.
How do you approach that? I mean, that's a lot of difference between a size 0 and a size 26.
I don't know. I've been doing it for so long, and everyone tells me I'm good at it. So I think I'm doing something right. No, but
our fits are, I mean, that's, I think, one of the things we're known for is our fits. To Christine's point, I think we have a tremendous customer base in different sizes, too. So you do that really well, Kim.
So the three of you are like incredibly calm, as were Mark and James when we were speaking to them about the business. Mm-hmm. And something that Mark mentioned, which is mind-boggling, is that you have 180 collections a year.
Yes.
Is that right? Well, but it's openings or whatever,
right.
Obviously, with all of your licensees. So when you think forward to the future, because things are changing, or need to be changing, you know, how do you feel, how are you changing that calendar or some of the typical things that we've constantly done in this fashion cycle? Or how are you looking to change it in the future, I would ask you all.
Well, I think that we tried the wear now, buy now for a short period of time. We did it for about a year. And I think we were too early to the game on it. And it now seems to be something that's kind of, you know, continuing to progress. So I don't know what the future will hold as far as that. But, you know, the whole industry has to come forward as a whole for it to work. You know, so the retailers have got to be on a different schedule, which at the time just wasn't the case. So it was feeling a little bit disjointed. But we're also just looking at things differently, like different business models, such as Rent the Runway. It was, you know, a very exciting concept when, you know, the two gens, the founders, came up to our showroom and pitched us this brand new idea of a closet in the cloud and renting out our dresses so that people could have them for a fraction of the cost. And a lot of brands said no, no, no. You know, they were worried about their, you know, department store business and their other retailers. And we really saw it differently. We saw it as a really exciting opportunity, a way to attain a new customer. We thought it was a different customer. And I think it's interesting now how much it has evolved and what a great partnership it's become. And I think it's going to be something that you see more and more of in the future. I mean, already competitors are propping up, but nobody's doing it as great as they are.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, something that's been interesting for us to kind of figure out is how to get on a new calendar altogether. And we've got some like great partnerships. Like I think like the SAP app after the fashion show, we got a lot of like hits on like what was the most liked on the runway. So I think we're trying to use real time data to some extent to figure out what our next steps are. But before, I would say the day of the fashion show, there would still be 20 dresses coming in, like pattern makers fixing things. And I think we've become really good at saying we're going to figure out what we believe in. Mark and James have got a really strong vision. And the clothes have been in our showroom probably for about 3 weeks. And they're really confident, I think, in how they're doing things. So I think we can kind of move on to the next season and keep moving forward, which before I feel like we were, I don't know what has changed for us, but I think before there was always that, the fashion show's tomorrow, I think I need to add a new pant, and it's not like that anymore. I think where you're like kind of figuring out what we want, who we want to be. They're figuring out the look for the season and standing behind it earlier. So we've been able to get on a new calendar, which has been really helpful, I think, all around for everybody.
So I don't think we talked about the SAP partnership when we had the conversation with Mark and James. What was that? What happened at the runway show with SAP's technology?
So we launched a new app with them called Runway by SAP. And we started it a few years ago with them, and the technology has advanced so much, and we keep working with them and letting them know, you know, what it is, what's the next step for us, what do we want to see next. And they're just such an amazing partner in developing that technology. So as of now, it's machine learning. So you hold your phone either if you're seated live at the runway show or you're watching a live stream on our website or on Instagram, you hold your phone up to the screen and it reads you everything about that look that you might want to know. It gives you all the data, all the information. You can like it, love it. You can pre-order it. It's amazing. And so if you do pre-order it, then when it's available and in stores, you'll get an email right away saying, we know you love this. You know you wanted it. Do you want to be the first to own it? And so I think that that's exciting for customers.
Okay. That's interesting. How did you get involved in it? Did they approach you or?
IMG originally made the connection and they knew we were looking for a new technology partner, and they knew SAP was looking for a new fashion partner. So it came together, and we've had just such great success with it. I mean, in the beginning, it was beacons, and each model was wearing a beacon. And so as you had to be live there at the show, and when the model would pass by your phone and your phone would register the beacon, then it would tell you about it. But now, I mean, it has just developed where it's unbelievable because the runway, it's a global stage now. And so we have millions of people logging in to live stream and watch the show, and that they're all then going on this Runway by SAP app and giving us their immediate feedback of the looks that they either like or love or want to pre-order. So then that helps you, you know, and or Lara, you know, when she's sitting in these buying appointments, to be able to sit down with Neiman Marcus the day after the show and say, look, the data has shown me that this is the best look. You know, you might be wavering between these two, but the data is saying this, which then when it hits retail stores has that much greater of a chance of selling through and being productive merchandise.
That is so powerful.
I wonder if this will be a technological pushback against the look for less, which drives me crazy because that's not the look. Because now with the machine learning, what they call the machine vision, where the computer can identify that is this dress that's in this catalog. Because
right.
I've seen it, you know, from every angle, it's been scanned. And
exactly. You know the technology behind it.
It's in the computer. So, yeah, if you point this app at a similar dress, it will not say that's this dress from Bagley Mishka.
And right.
It will say, I don't know what that is. Stop pointing me at it.
So I want to bring us around to talking about female leadership. And I know that the three of you you started out by saying that you all worked together somewhat in the past. But as far as even public companies go, there are not a lot of women that are founders in leading companies, and fewer as you kind of go into privately held. So this is tremendous and to be really admired. So what are you doing or what do you believe that you're doing maybe differently in terms of mentoring the people that are working for you, the women that are working for you specifically, to prepare them differently for the future than maybe they would have been somewhere else?
I mean, I think one of the things that if you walked into our office, it's definitely a family environment. I think that we take the different people within our company. We appreciate them. We try to grow them in any way possible. There's no limit to where they can go. We don't say you're in this department and this is the top of the chain that you can get to. But I think we also support the women in our office to have lives. So I've had, you know, three people work for me who have now, they started when they were really young, right out of college. Now they're married. Now they have kids. And I think letting them know that they can be moms and they can have this other life and still be successful, I think, is really important. And I think sometimes that's what stops women in the fashion industry, is that they feel like they have to choose which direction they're going to go into. For us, I try to be as flexible as possible. I've got really busy market periods and I need everyone 100%. And then there's periods of time where they can work in a different way. And I think that's been really key to not only keeping great employees, but letting them understand that they can have families and they can have this whole other life as a woman and still be really successful and grow. I don't know. I think we're all like that within our departments, but I think that's been very important. And I think them just seeing us and what we've accomplished, I think, says a lot to them, and they know that that's our goal for them. We want them to grow to whatever place they want to be.
When we launched our children's wear collection, Mark and James picked people from the office, their daughters, to put in the runway and have walked down the runway show to launch the kids wear. You know, they didn't pick models. And so I think right there, it just speaks to kind of the family atmosphere and how much we appreciate the kids and the moms and everybody's that's in there working.
That's great.
Are you still headquartered in the garment district here in Midtown?
We recently moved.
Okay.
So we are on 52nd Street, in Midtown, in the
really?
Plaza district.
Yeah. Wow.
I was very against it in the beginning because factories are down in Fashion District. The trims are there. But we've made it works. Because the train system there really works.
We're really where our customer is. You know, we're by, you know, the banks, the lawyers, the architects, the women that you see on the street there, they are our customer. And so I think it's really exciting to see on a day-to-day when we go lunch and walk around. It's fun.
Wow, you go to lunch also.
And I think it's nice, too. We're close to Saks and we're close to Bergdorf. I think we're sort of more in the hub in Nordstrom that just opened up. It's definitely, it's a different environment where we are, but I think it's been actually really, I don't know, refreshing for everyone to be out of the garment district.
And the other thing is the big caveat to the move was we wanted to come together with the different product categories. So now we're under one roof. So shoes and apparel and other categories of Bagley Mishka are all moving under one house. So it's really special.
That's great. Yes. And that makes it easy.
Yes.
And it's a small boutique building, and it's great. Yeah, I think we are really, really happy with our decision.
How do you approach, as a company, the move toward sustainability? And obviously, by making special pieces, you're already doing something, because you're selling something people don't immediately throw away after they wear it once. But in terms of using sustainable materials and processes, how are you thinking about that? How are you approaching it? And is it difficult for a company your size to get into that?
I think it's not something you can do overnight, you know, and I think the brands that do it really well work really hard and long at it, and they should be, you know, celebrated for that. And, you know, I think every single day we're making progress and continue to strive to do that through things like Rent the Runway, which is fantastic at the fact that these dresses are continually recycled, through our partnership with SAP and getting data and information on the styles we're producing. To Kim's point, what she was talking about before, is not overproducing. We really are cutting to order and making sure that the clothes have a home before they're made. I think it's really important in this day and age to try to do every measure you possibly can in the process.
And how do you police that with your brand partners?
The same thing, you know, through all of these meetings and conversations and time face to face with them, everybody knows that it's a priority and we want to attack it in the same manner.
So, Kim, from a production, supply chain, raw materials standpoint, how are you finding it best to roll out sustainable practices?
It's kind of hard for me to answer because of what we do. It's obviously, it's something for more of our ready-to-wear. We would love to try to do something like that. So it'll be like the chemicals that we use to dye the fabrics and stuff. So I was actually, Christine connected them with me, how to make, what was that thing that they were doing with the fabric I was telling you guys? It was like so interesting. Like,
it was with the silk, right?
Yeah, it was like using the silk worm, the, what's that? I don't know. They were using it so that it actually, when they reweave it, it makes like the fabric. So something that we would actually be able to use, because it does it for silk. So it uses less chemicals. And when it does dye, it picks up the dye very well. So you don't have to over use the chemical. It was just like really interesting. But unfortunately, it's only for silk right now. They don't have it for polyester. And we've been moving away from silk and into polyester a little bit more because of the durability of the fabrics, because we have a lot of beading. So when you have the beading, it damages the silk. So we had to move in a different direction. So she said it's coming soon. So when that does happen, we'll let Christine do another podcast.
Do you have someone inside the company whose job is to be an advocate for sustainability and track all the trends and things that are coming along with new textiles and things?
I think it's just on the forefront of everybody in the company's mind. You know, everybody's talking about it every day. So I think it's something we're all thinking of.
It's a big process, yes. Actually.
Yes. So is bridal still a big part of the company and what you produce?
Yes, bridal is still very much part of the brand DNA, an exciting part of the business. We're known in the bridal world, especially with the shoe business. The shoes are on every bride out to be and across Pinterest and everywhere, which is, you know, so exciting. I think, you know, when Mark and James travel around and they go do these different personal appearances, they love meeting the customer and getting inside the dressing room. And whether they're getting married soon or they were married 50 years ago, they bring this pair of shoes and they have Mark and James sign the sole of every shoe. And they make lines out the door. I mean, it is truly unbelievable. Yes.
There's definitely a community around the brand. There's a lot of fans. Do you get a chance to talk to them very often? Do Mark and James get a chance to
talk
to them?
They do. They're, you know, I would say that, like, for example, this last year they did 9 Neiman Marcus PA, so that's just one example. They also were going back and forth, and they were bi-coastal living in LA, and we have our flagship store there. So they were probably in the store at least 3 to 4 times a week, meeting customers, helping with fittings. They're really approachable, so they're great at doing personal appearances. But I think for them, when they left, I thought, oh my goodness, that's a lot of personal appearances to do. And they were all over the country, so they were flying for like a 1 month period from store to store to store. And they told me that it was probably the most rewarding experience they've had in a really long time, just meeting the customers, understanding who they were, what they loved about the brand, and just to see the excitement, I think, for them to meet the actual people that are wearing their clothes was unbelievable for them. I got to do a few with them, and that was a lot of fun for me as well. And I think in general, we really like to be close to the customer. I think that's a key to sort of our success and who we are. And that's a great thing about having two designers that are actually designing the clothes and still a part of the business, to be able to have them be a part of the actual retail experience is amazing.
And do you yourselves actually communicate with customers through Instagram?
Yes, heavily.
Wow.
Yep. And it's funny, you know, Mark and James are... Mark, it took him a little bit of time to get into the world of social media. He is now on Instagram all the time, and he'll be like, oh my goodness, I saw this beautiful girl, hashtagged our brand. And he's so excited by it now. So we have conversations daily about who's wearing our clothes, and it's normally just regular people, and he's following the hashtag. And James is a little bit more high tech, so he's like, yeah, I've been doing this for a while. But for Mark, it's been really exciting for him to see that part of it.
Very often when you see a successful brand, you have a designer and a business person. There's almost always two people at the top of a successful fashion brand. But in this case, there's two designers and then three business people who are running things to make sure that they have time to focus on that public image and the design itself. How do you coordinate between the three of you to make sure you're covering everything with them?
Well, I think the partnership started out with very distinct, you know, roles and areas of expertise and the history that people had come from. So I think it was a natural, and I think it's worked out. I mean, the fact that, you know, to your point, there's not many companies that have five partners and now a dozen years later are still, you know, working so well with one another and still best friends. So I think... You know, we have a formula for success. And I think they're just also really supportive of a female leadership team. You know, when you look at the stats and what's happening, I think PwC just recently put out a report saying there was 12.5% in the Fortune 1000 of apparel companies that were run by women. And 12.5%, I mean, that is just a shocking percentage to me. Considering, you know, I think finance and aerospace, they were quoting, are closer to 20%, you know, and those are industries that you would, you know, the history has been male run. So I think something like fashion, where there's 80% of, you know, people coming up through the schools are women. So what happened? So I think they're really, you know, just tremendous proponents of the business of having it be female run. And it's worked out for us.
And I think it's trust too. We just trust each other. If she had to make a decision, if she made it, we'll back her up 100%. Like, we don't second guess your decisions. I think that's what works for the five of us. So even if Mark and James aren't here, they trust the fact that we'll make the right decision and we'll let them know after what we did, and it works.
But to your point, I think a lot of those partnerships often are a female designer and then a male sort of finance person running it. And I think what ends up happening is, although of course everybody wants a business to be successful, I'm not necessarily sure that they're aligned in where they want the business to go. And I think we're very aligned. We care obviously about the product. We care about producing beautiful clothes. We care about sustainability. We care about our employees. I think we have a lot of things in common. And of course we need to run a business that, you know, we can make some money and we can pay everybody, but I think we're aligned in what we want as a company. And because it's not two separate worlds, we all sort of come together and make really good decisions, I think most of the time. Not all the time, but most of the time.
It's not two separate worlds, and you're two teams, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's really powerful.
I do too. And we always talk about how blessed we are, which is an interesting thing. But I think part of maybe creating a company is really finding the right partnerships, because I think it's easy to find someone that has money. I think it's easy, even as we were looking to buy back the brand, that was some of the things that we came across. There would be companies that we just knew in the end, if we became partners with them, we were going to lose our ability to have a say. We're going to lose our ability to really create the product that we wanted. So I think it's finding the right partnerships and people that want the same things and are aligned with you. And I think if you can find that, you've got a great chance of success.
I know a lot of the workforce for making clothing in the New York area is aging out. How are you thinking about workforce development and making sure that you have the talent in-house to be able to execute things on a nimble basis locally?
Well, we only produce couture locally, so now we're talking about a different venture where we have to go explore other places besides China. And that's my to-do list this year, to see other countries where we might be able to produce stuff that... But again, it's just really hard because it's a dying trait, kind of like... It's, you don't wake up in the morning and go, I want to become a seamstress. It's like, so it is a little tough.
Some people do. They're listening to the show.
Okay.
Hello.
Well, I hope so. Call me. But so that's where it's a little hard. And I just noticed hotels are moving into the fashion industry too. Like, so it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So most of the factories are being, their leases aren't being renewed. So it's not like they want to leave. It's they kind of being forced out right now. So that's another problem that we have to kind of look into or face. And luckily, the factories that we have are small offices because it's couture dresses, so you don't need a big space. So that's the one thing. But if I were to do large production, it would be very challenging to do it in New York City. But
so most of your ready-to-wear is overseas?
Overseas.
We've been fortunate enough to, you know, be very diversified with... you know, resources coming from all sorts of different countries, and Kim's working with, you know, all sorts of different manufacturing channels. So I think navigating that in the face of everything that's happening has been quite interesting.
I mean, there are not that many factories. This is a blanket statement, but I feel as if I can say that right now. There are not that many luxury, you know, factories in New York producing luxury goods.
Yeah, it's like sample rooms, so mini lots. So an order for like 50 pieces and under, you'll probably find factories like that. But large lot factories, it's really hard to come by. But Brooklyn, they opened up in the Navy Yard. A lot of those factories have moved down there. Cutting rooms have moved there. So
things are moving around the city. We kind of lost the fight for the Garment Center. I was working on Save the Garment Center. I was the director of communications for, two or three years now? And we lost the fight with the city council over the zoning law. They've changed the zoning law where the protections won't be there. And I can see their point where... this is a thing that was set up in the 80s where 8 million square feet were protected in a couple of blocks. And now the garment industry takes up less than 2 million square feet. So why is 8 million square feet still protected? But removing the entire protection is tragic. So we'll see a lot of change in where people are and where people are still in business in the next year and a half, 2 years. There will be change, and it's happening very rapidly now because of this change with the city government. So, we haven't seen the fallout yet.
Mm-mm. No, it's very sad.
Yeah.
And even our building that we were in for many years was sort of the premier building, and little by little, year by year, it became less and less fashion companies. And I think by the time we left, they were sort of like, we're going to turn it over to some more of a technology building. But it was sad because it was one of those old, really kind of nostalgic buildings that everyone knew as being an important building in the fashion industry and factories. I mean, we've had a lot of talks with, we have some manufacturing partners in New York, and they're constantly getting moved around, and their leases all of a sudden are going to be ended early, and they're constantly trying to figure out where they're going to go. So
there's space in the Navy Yard, there's space at the Army Terminal, but that's way out in Brooklyn, and most of the garment workers live in Queens, the Bronx, and New Jersey. So getting out to Sunset Park or to the Navy Yard,
It's not, not realistic. Easy. Not realistic.
Right.
At all.
If you're running around buying trim or linings or anything like that, yeah, and then going to Brooklyn.
I live in Harlem. It takes me 90 minutes to get to Bay Ridge. So, and Sunset Park's almost Bay Ridge. So, yeah, that's all really long commute, especially for people in their 60s and 70s who are the experts in these things. How did you three get into this business? Laura, how did you get into this?
You know, I started right out of college. You know, when you first move to New York City and you're young, you're always trying to figure out how you're going to get your first job. And I'd met someone.
Did you study fashion?
No, I had a general just kind of marketing and public relations degree. And I went to a boarding school, and there was someone that went there who owned a fashion company, and I reached out and started working there. But it was really, it was one of those situations where I came to New York and I'm like, I'm going to work in fashion. I'm going to figure it out. And I did. So that was great for me. And I met Christine and Kim in one company, and then we all kind of went off and did our own things and came back together again. So it was an exciting time, though. I think when I graduated college, it was 1999. I'm now giving away my age now. So in 2000, to be in the fashion business, it was a really exciting time, I think, in New York City. And yeah, we all had different sort of expertise. And Christine was in licensing and branding when I first met her. Kim was always in production. And I actually started off in the marketing PR side and ended up switching gears. So I think that's another thing. You can definitely do that in the fashion industry. I think when you have knowledge of one part of the business, it's easy to switch gears, and ended up overseeing retail stores and wholesale businesses. So, yeah, it was a fun time.
And, Kim, how did you get into fashion?
It was a fluke. It really was. I was in high school, didn't know what I wanted to do, and then my girlfriend, one of my best friends, was applying for Fashion Institute, so FIT. I go, oh, that sounds fun. I'm going to do that too. And that's just literally how I got into fashion. My father was like, are you crazy? And I'm like, but my best friend's going. And so lo and behold, that's how I started. And I took pattern making classes, fashion buying classes and all this stuff. And then I was like, is this really for me? And then I went and took a part-time job at the first company I started with. I was like, let me just make sure this is what I really want to do, because I didn't know anything about fashion. And they were great. And I was actually a receptionist. And then the president was like, can you be my secretary too? And I was like, I can't be a receptionist and a secretary. This is a lot of work to do. I thought something to do with fashion. I said that I will be your secretary. I will be the receptionist if you give me an opportunity to do something else. Meaning if you wanted me to work in sales or design or in production, let me try out and I'll just juggle everything. Because back then we had fax machines. I'm much older than them. And so you could type everything and then fax it at night because it was overseas. So it didn't ever interfere with my day job. So I'd be answering phones. And then I was like, I think I like production. And that's how I began. And it's like 20-something years now. So so the fluke, it worked. My best friend from high school. Thank you.
Are you still friends?
I had a story that I told it. We lost touch.
It happens.
But I thank her anyway.
And you, what did you study to become the president of Beckley Mishka?
Well, I studied apparel design. So similar to Laura, I started out with a different career path. And at the time, I thought to be in fashion, you have to be a designer. Didn't understand the business of fashion and all the options behind it. And so I graduated with an apparel design degree, and I came to New York, and I got an internship for a designer, and I started out as an assistant designer, and then quickly realized that my designs were not up to par with a lot of my colleagues who came out of Parsons and FIT and all these amazing fashion schools. And I definitely was far more business-minded, and thankfully they saw that and, you know, switched gears for me into the licensing world. And I think that it helped me in the beginning of having the design degree behind me. So I really understood when I was sitting with all these different licensees, looking at their product, what goes into it and what's behind it, and helping, you know, that designer make sure it was what she was looking for. And anyway, it just transpired from there.
Well, thank you all for coming and talking to us. This was fascinating.
Wonderful.
Can't wait to see the show.
I know. Thank you so much for having us. It was a lot of fun.
thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, the archives. With roughly 250 episodes published, the old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online. On Twitter, we are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show, and I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.